From 1965 to 1971, King Records on Brewster Avenue here in Cincinnati housed James Brown Productions, a music company which created a new genre of music, had many hit records, and was involved in the civil rights and Black Pride movements. James Brown's recording career spanned over 50 years, and during that time, he also collaborated with many local musicians. During the next hour, you'll hear music historian Brian Powers talk with Alan Leeds, who worked with Brown as publicity director and then tour manager. David Matthews shares his memories of being James Brown's arranger for 5 years. Carmen De Leon talks about his friendship with David Matthews and the recording sessions he sat in on at King Records. And Chuck Sullivan talks about being a guitarist on a Bobby Bird recording session at King Records and playing with Lonnie Mack and Bo Dollar. I'm Lee Hay, and this is James Brown Productions Part 1 on WVXU.
This is Alan Leeds, and I worked for James Brown Productions in Cincinnati from 1969 until 1971 as publicity director and then as tour manager.
When did you first meet James Brown?
I met James Brown in July of 1965. I was then an apprentice radio disc jockey on a small radio station in Richmond, Virginia. It was the sole music station of Richmond, the only one in town, and as such, they promoted most of the musical concerts that came through town. James Brown was appearing in Richmond that particular night, and I begged the program director to let me go to his hotel and do an interview that we could use on the radio to hype ticket sales and so on, and tie the station closer to the identity of having James Brown representing the station. And he called James Brown and set it up, and I schlepped a big, heavy tape recorder over to Mr. Brown's hotel, knocked on the door, and a woman answered, a very attractive woman, who later learned, of course, was his girlfriend at the time. She looked at me kind of strange, I suppose, because they weren't accustomed to having 17-year-old pimply-faced white kids come to do interviews for black radio stations. But nonetheless, there I was and introduced myself, and she escorted me in. And I walked into the bedroom of the hotel suite, and there was Mr. Brown laying in bed with his head propped up on the headboard, just surrounded by about 5 pillows. My first reaction was, my God, look at all the hair. Of course, this was the era when Mr. Brown was wearing the famous pompadour hairstyle. It was probably the longest hairstyle that he ever wore in his whole career.
How did it lead to you actually working for him as an employee?
Yeah, actually, what I learned that first day was that anybody who had a shift on a radio station was his best friend. I mean, James Brown was the best promoter of James Brown that ever lived. And he recognized that his fortunes, which depended on airplay of his records, depended entirely on those who played the records. So he befriended every disc jockey in the world. And his attitude was that you might be a part-time disc jockey who might only be on the air for an hour a day or maybe only on weekends. But who knows, but maybe a year from now you'll be the music director of that station. You never know. So it was his idea to befriend everybody, and that included me that particular day. And he gave me a lengthy interview, did some drops for my radio show, and by the time I left out of there, he had me thinking I was the next Dick Clark. Of course, when I went to work for him years later, I realized that just about every disc jockey he ever talked to had the same feeling when they left. So it was hardly unique. But for whatever reason, we clicked. And to this day, I'm not sure why. And from that point on, every time his show appeared anywhere in the Virginia area, I would get in my car and drive to the show and beg, borrow, steal my way backstage and hang out. And I got to know the guys in his band, and I got to know the Famous Flames, Bobby Bird, Baby Lloyd, Bobby Bennett, and got to know some of the guys who worked for him in his office. And, of course, got to know him better. And I would see him, I suppose, through the 60s, I want to say 5-6 times a year at least. And flash forward to 1969, and by then I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, going to college. And he had a show coming through Pittsburgh. He knew I was there. For whatever reason, his local promoter in the Pittsburgh area had some beef with him. They had some problems. So I got a phone call from one of his agents one afternoon asking if I would be willing to be the local promoter for his upcoming show, which meant hanging posters and placing newspaper and radio advertisements and monitoring the whole campaign and so on. And they promoted the show at the Pittsburgh Arena. The show happened to sell out. He was impressed and offered me a job. This was in the fall of 69. And of course, he was still with King Records. His touring offices and his recording offices were based in Cincinnati out of King Records. He had office space within the King Records complex on Brewster. And I was first brought to do publicity because I guess what impressed him about my Pittsburgh concert was the fact that I had gotten a lot of advance publicity from local newspapers and so on. And he wondered if I could do that in every city. Of course, I said yes, having absolutely no idea whether I could. I was there for about 6 months, and then somebody in his tour directing crew left the business, and I was promoted up as an assistant tour director, and then eventually took over the booking of the tours.
Well, that had to be a big job, because didn't he do more than 300 shows a year?
Pretty much. I mean, we didn't use the word tour in those days. I mean, this doesn't just apply to Brown. It applies to any artist who was in demand. The whole economics of the touring industry was much different than it is today. It wasn't the huge money where an artist can go on the road for 3 months out of the year and make millions. You know, James was very, very successful in his era, but it was nothing like what they do today. So it was pretty much a mom-and-pop business. It hadn't really been corporatized yet. And he promoted the bulk of his shows himself, which is why he had this office of tour managers, because we would book the venues in every city. We would hire a local promoter, usually someone associated with a radio station in that town. And then we would do everything from order the tickets to order the posters and order the radio ads and the newspaper ads. And we did all that from our office at King Records.
How big was the staff there at James Brown Productions on Brewster Avenue? I mean, how many people were working?
Let's see. Let me count. There was Bud Hobgood, who was the production manager, and he had nothing to do with the tours. Bud handled the production of James Brown production recordings. There was Speedy Brown, no relation to James, who was by trade a photographer, but he was also James's record promotion man. He would go town to town visiting disc jockeys promoting the product. And then in the touring end of the business, there were, let's see, three of us. Bob Patton, who was from Middletown, Ohio, and had been a disc jockey in Dayton and moved to Cincinnati to work for Brown. And there was an agent from New York named Buddy Nolan who had moved there when James moved his office. And then there were two or three clerical people whose names, forgive me, I can't quite remember, but I would say the touring staff in the office was six of us. And it was a lot of work, but the touring business was so radically different because we didn't just go on tour for 3 months and then come off. He didn't call it touring, he called it work. It was his job. And that's how he looked at it. Every show was his job, and it was just as anybody else would get up and go to work that day. That's what he saw himself doing. The only difference was that he brought a band and a show somewhere. So we worked on the average of 4 to 5 nights a week, 51 weeks out of the year.
And he had quite a lot of people part of his show as his operation, didn't he, on his road show?
Let's see, there had to have been 5 or 6 technicians. There was wardrobe people, there was dancers, backup singers, and a large band. So I would say we probably had 35 to 40 people on the road at most times. We used to liken it to the circus and the Harlem Globetrotters because in the attraction business, we would talk to venue managers and we would behave as if that was the kind of show we had because we would come through cities on the average of twice a year, which was a lot. You know, you risked overexposure in today's touring industry. That would have been taboo. You know, there's only so many cities. So to keep working, you do the circuit and then circle back and hit it again. So you develop friends and colleagues in each city at the radio stations with the various promotion companies at the theaters and arenas, the venues. And it ended up becoming kind of an extended family after a while because you'd come back to these cities and work with the same people over and over again, eat in the same restaurants, stay in the same hotels. So a lot of it became quite familiar after the first year or two.
Yeah, and I would see old ads in newspapers for James Brown in other cities. And sometimes he would do two shows, like a matinee show sometimes and a night show.
Often, when we played theaters, because the capacities were much smaller than arenas, we would often do two shows. This is really hard to believe these days, but when you played what they called the Chitlin' Circuit, which were the major black theaters in major cities, there were 4 or 5 cities, starting with New York's famous Apollo Theater, but there were similar theaters in Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Chicago. And in those theaters, we would do as many as four and sometimes five shows a day. The shows would be 90 minutes long. They'd take a break, turn the audience over, show a brief film, and then start the thing all over again. And the shows would start at 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
You know, there was one article I found where they mentioned you and Bob Patton. It was the Soul Bowl down in New Orleans.
Yeah, that was kind of a special show. In those days, when I went to work for him, it was just a year after Woodstock. The idea of festivals was still pretty fresh, and they weren't too common. But the city of New Orleans decided to have a show called the Soul Bowl, and it was in a huge football field at Tulane University. And it was James Brown, it was Isaac Hayes, Ike and Tina Turner, Junior Walker, and the All-Stars. I can't remember who all, but it was one of these all-day, started 2 o'clock in the afternoon and ended midnight festivals with just one act after another. And it was literally, for that era, it was an all-star show. And of course, Mr. Brown was the headliner. The thing started out peacefully enough because they had this stage in the football field. So the fans were in the bleachers surrounding the football field. And like a lot of university fields, surrounding the football field was a track used for track and field events. And the bleachers were on the other side of the track. And that held for most of the afternoon. But during Isaac Hayes' set, right before we were scheduled to come on stage, a lot of the kids in the stands, and I guess, you know, they've been there for 5 or 6 hours by now, and probably had a few beers and smoked a little weed. And by then, they were wanting to get closer to the action. I went out there in the middle of Isaac Hayes' set and saw that all of a sudden, the football field was completely packed with kids who had come down from the stands and just overcome security. I mean, there was just no hope of holding them back. There were thousands of kids. There wasn't enough security to hold them back and keep them in the stands. They had basically just taken over the football field, which was, you know, it was kind of cool. It actually created a more exciting ambiance. They were closer to the stage. And as a result, it benefited the entertainers as well, because it's kind of hard to play to an audience that's 100 yards from you. The only problem with this, it didn't leave a path to the stage. So now you had a problem of getting the entertainers on and off the stage, because the locker rooms that they were using as dressing rooms were under the stadium, easily 200 yards from the stage. So the whole evening's drama turned into, how in the world are we going to get James Brown from this locker room onto the stage? And we met with the police and the security and the promoters of the event, and everybody had different ideas. But literally the only thing we could do was put him in a car and drive to the stage. Now, in order to do that, you had to drive through these thousands of kids because there was no pathway. So they got as many police as they could, and they formed a kind of a ramrod around the car. Bob Patton was behind the wheel. I was in the car with Mr. Brown and one or two of his bodyguards. And the car inched towards the stage, moving literally, it couldn't have been 4 or 5 miles an hour. And as we went through the crowd, the kids just reluctantly parted ways and were banging on the top of the car, were banging on the windows. It sounded like I thought we were in Vietnam. Inside the car, it was the scariest, scariest thing I'd ever witnessed in my life. And of course, nobody meant any harm. These were all kids who just adored James Brown. You know, we kept the windows up. If we'd have lowered the windows, it would have been curtains. But it must have took 10, 15 minutes to get from the locker room to the stage. And then finally, just inertia pushed us up the stairs onto the stage. And then, of course, I found myself stuck up there because there was no way to get back down and get back across the field. So I ended up sitting on the side of the stage for the whole show. But it was pretty crazy.
And, you know, one of the things that you have become over the years is a James Brown archivist. There's been a lot of James Brown reissues, and you tend to be the guy who writes the liner notes. So you seem to know every recording that James Brown probably ever did.
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean, I was like so many people who get in the music business, I was a fan first. And when James left King Records and we moved our offices in the summer of 71 and signed with Polydor Records, that meant moving our offices for the tour as well. And he decided to move those offices to his hometown, Augusta, Georgia. So we were cleaning out the offices and dumping stuff, and there were vials of stuff, and I just asked him if I could have the stuff he was willing to trash. And he was like, take whatever you want. So I managed to get a lot of data and background on recording sessions and his touring itineraries and stuff that, you know, the average person would have absolutely no use for. But I just held on to it over the years. And so when Polydor began a reissue series in the early 90s of all his material, I had befriended some of the execs at Polydor, and they said, hey, you want to be part of this? So I was hired as a freelancer, but a freelance producer to work with Harry Wenger, who was the captain of that ship, and have been involved with all the reissues of all the James Brown material that Polydor has released in the last, oh, I guess, 20-some years. And it's really been a privilege and a pleasure. I mean, it's an absolute labor of love. It's like getting paid to do a hobby.
Hello, I'm Carmen De Leon, music director for Cincinnati Ballet for 50 years now, and sometime drummer at King Studios.
You're very well known as a conductor and composer in the Cincinnati area, but I don't think a lot of people know that you did a couple of James Brown recordings back in 1969, and I was wondering how that came about.
Well, the connection here is with my roommate, David Matthews. Dave Matthews, not that Dave Matthews, but the one who graduated from the Conservatory of Music. We were together from the year 1960. We hit it off right away because he was another French horn player. Actually, French horn is my actual instrument. And we spent as much time outside of the conservatory as we did in the conservatory. Dave was studying composition seriously with Felix Lebunsky. I was studying French horn, and we played a lot of gigs every weekend. We were working. He is a keyboard player, and I as a drummer. And that's how we worked our way through school. And it was like that until I started with the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra as an assistant conductor. So Dave was the connection to King Studios. He was kind of discovered by James Brown and invited to become his conductor and his arranger. He did a series of arrangements. So Dave would call on the guys that he knew from the conservatory to come over and record some of these sessions when he wanted to do bigger things, things outside of just a rhythm section. So I played French horn on several of the recordings. And then occasionally I played drums on two specific things. On an album that's called It's a Mother, I was playing on the Burt Bacharach tune, Any Day Now, which is kind of a neat arrangement. And then an arrangement that Dave did of Bewildered of James. There are a lot of recordings online of James singing Bewildered, but it's usually in a live performance. But this was a studio recording, and you can hear horns and so on. And those guys who are playing horns are primarily our friends here in Cincinnati.
Yeah, what's interesting, if you look at the sessions, the guys who were playing on those sessions that you were on, you'll see some names that have a local connection, like Frank Vincent and Kenny Poole.
Yeah, Frank Vincent, Kenny Poole. What I remember are some of the brass players that were playing. The famous Frank Brown, one of the great trumpet players ever in Cincinnati, was involved in most of those sessions. And also Marie Speziali, who was our classmate at CCM, playing trumpet, who went on to have a great career as a trumpeter with the Cincinnati Symphony and many other orchestras. And then Paul Piller played trombone. Paul is currently the contractor for the Broadway shows at the Air and Off. So there's a lot of connections here. And there were some reed players, too. Our other roommate was Marty Reduns. He's now out in Las Vegas, but he played sax on some of the sessions. And so did Mike Andrus and those well-known players from here in Cincinnati. These were the guys that Dave Matthews knew. And since I was his roommate, he pulled me along to many of those sessions as well. And specifically, for some reason, he needed a drummer for those two, at least. I think there were some others. There was a singer by the name of Marvo Whitney, who was a protege of James Brown. And I did some drumming on one of the songs that she did.
Yeah, she did quite a lot of recording for James Brown Productions, and she had a couple of hits, too. What do you remember much about those sessions or much working with James Brown in those sessions?
Most of those sessions, the ones that I'm speaking of, I think James really wasn't present. He wasn't there at the studio. I was there a lot when James was there, just kind of observing. And at one point, he shouted at me and thought I was trying to steal some of his licks. I was just hanging around to be with Dave and to learn as much about recording as I could. But he was kind of protective of his thing, that's for sure. And then one time, for some reason, I happened to be out in Las Vegas. I think I had performed on the All-American College show with a trio. And on our way home, we stopped in Vegas, and James was there, and Dave was with the group. He was conducting the orchestra in one of the clubs in Vegas, and they were having a rehearsal in the afternoon, and I played some of that rehearsal. But even there, James was not present at that particular rehearsal. So I didn't have a lot of one-on-one contact with James Brown.
Well, it seems interesting that he was kind of broadening his horizons, it seems. I mean, like you mentioned, he was doing a Burt Bacharach song then. I was wondering if you knew David, his arranger, David Matthews. Did David ever comment about James Brown, what he was trying to do with his music at that particular time?
But I did a little bit of reading about this, and it seems like evidently some people, or maybe James himself, decided that he was going to go in another kind of direction, sort of a Frank Sinatra kind of direction at one point, maybe the early 70s, late 60s. And he was having a lot of success with the live band, so the band members were wondering what's going on here. It probably wasn't a very good fix, but, you know, he also did a couple of those CDs with Frank Vincent and Dee Felice, a real sort of a jazz setting as well. Probably not perfectly suited to James. But Any Day Now was a hit tune, I think, by Chuck Jackson. And I think that's probably where JB heard the tune. That's around the late 60s where that happened. And that was right around the same time that Dave started doing arrangements for James. So it did kind of coincide, but I'm not sure about the inner workings of it, but it certainly did seem that way.
Any day now, I will hear you say goodbye, my love. All right, and you be on your way.
There's a longer story about this, an interesting story. I have some photographs of a recording session of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. I was already on the staff of the symphony, and it shows the orchestra in session, and I'm playing drums in the back of the orchestra near the trumpet section. And this was a recording session for James Brown. There were actually arrangements done by Dave Matthews for James for full symphony orchestra. And several of the tunes were recorded, but it was right around the time when James had switched to record labels, and there was a lot of confusion. I think money was not paid, and I don't believe he ever overdubbed his voice onto these tracks. Somewhere these things exist, but I don't know where they are. For instance, I think there were a couple Beatles tunes on it, believe it or not. Come Together, for sure, I remember doing that song. And then, Please Send Me Someone to Love, I think was also on there. So hidden on somebody's shelf somewhere, I don't know, maybe an old Decca Records or whatever it was, are these arrangements for James Brown that were never completed.
Do you remember hearing that recording, some other, for the first time?
It's odd, but I don't think we listened a great deal at that time. But yeah, you know, I was thrilled to have the chance to play some drums on a James Brown record. some of his drummers, like Clyde Stubblefield and Bo Dollar, were like heroes of mine anyhow. They had a certain funk groove that I had not achieved as yet. So these kind of tunes maybe fit me a little better, but it was always a thrill to hear yourself on recording, no matter what it was. And the fact that James Brown was involved was even more thrilling. It's kind of fun to listen to them now, these many decades later. And of course, what you do is you criticize yourself. I believe I could have done a better job if I was doing it today, let's put it that way. It was a slice of history from pretty far back, and so it's nice to try to remember some of these things. And I know you've spoken also with my buddy Dave Matthews, who's now, of course, living in Japan, so we don't see each other that often, but he would have more accurate information about all of these things. But it was fortunate that we were in a town where this kind of recording was happening, and that there was that connection to the Conservatory of Music and those of us who were trying to bring jazz into the school and even funk and rock. It was a lovely period of time, a great memory.
Hello, this is David Matthews. Back in the early 70s, I was James Brown's arranger when I was living in Cincinnati. I was born in Kentucky in a very small town, and when I was pretty young, I think I showed my parents an interest in music. I went to a high school in Louisville that had a very good music program, and after that, I went to the College Conservatory of Music, the University of Cincinnati. I graduated from there with a degree in composition, and I was playing in a jazz house in Mount Adams, and James Brown's producer brought him to hear our band. This was with Jimmy McGarry and Grove Mooney, who were very accomplished and somewhat well-known musicians in Cincinnati. And we ended up making a demo for him, and he ended up hiring me for 5 years to make arrangements for his recording.
Now, you met James Brown, I think, around 68 or so, when he's starting to really develop funk music. He didn't have any formal music education, but you did. I was wondering, how did you collaborate?
Well, having a formal music education, that means I understand harmony quite well, and being a jazz musician, it means that I have a lot of experience with the rhythms. There's a certain type of musician who has no training at all, but has very good ears and very good memory and can make up things. They don't know how to write them down, but they don't need to write them down because some members of the band couldn't read it anyway. James and many, many other funk artists would sing phrases, licks, and rhythms to the band members. It was all like oral tradition from James's mouth, singing the phrases and things. So he didn't need somebody to write down music. Most of the guys in his band really were not very good readers at all. So I treated them the way I would treat any musician who's not a great reader, just sang it to them until we got the groove going, then turned the tape on. When I got to New York, I started using New York studio musicians who were quite capable of playing funky, but they were very, very good readers. So once I got to New York, then I would write out charts for James's recording, and we would record them with really wonderful New York musicians. And then James was always on the road. So like a month later, he would come in and listen to the arrangements, and then he would overdub, sing on top of them, and then they would release his next single. So that was how it worked.
Well, you know, one of the musicians that we've talked to from Cincinnati who says you were a big influence on him was Bootsy Collins, who at that time was a teenager playing in the King Records studios. But he said that you sort of took him under your wing to help him kind of learn some formal.
I don't remember it very well, but that is probably correct. Bootsy was one of the most talented of the funk musicians I've ever met. And we had been using him and his brother, Catfish, a couple of other musicians in the band that they had in Cincinnati. We had been using them for other artists. So when James's band quit, I had already been working with Bootsy and Catfish in the studio in Cincinnati. And so we're talking about education and writing music. None of those guys could read, at least not very well. Bootsy has told people that I taught him how to read. Well, I think he was such a great talent that he didn't need much teaching. The reading part of it, especially James Brown's rhythmic music, which is pretty repetitive, it didn't need a great reader. It needed a guy who could really play a funky groove. The reading and the conservatory, CCM part of it, really didn't affect the James Brown band. I kind of sang the stuff to them until they could play it, and then they played it great.
Now, James Brown, he had James Brown Productions there, and he would have a lot of people that were in his band, like Bobby Bird and I think Marva Whitney, who would release stuff on King. Were you involved with any of those sessions, any of these other artists that James Brown would bring in?
Yes, I think I arranged a bunch of singles for Vicki Anderson, who was Bobby Bird's wife. I don't think I recorded with Marva Whitney, but she was the girl singer on the road. So in the James Brown show, she was always up there. Well, not singing, she was dancing, I think. So the answer to your question is, yes, I was involved with some of these other people that James Brown was interested in. Now, I said the word people twice because James Brown, for recordings that were not his own, not James Brown records, he started a label there at King called People Records. He started that label for the purpose of recording other people that were associated with him, but they were not him. So Marva Whitney and Bobby Bird and Vicki Anderson and those people, I arranged a bunch of tracks, some of which later became albums, for People Records. And it was James Brown's Funky People that were the artists on those recordings.
So James had his road band, he would record with them, but you know, it was at King in Cincinnati, he did some collaborations or worked with other local Cincinnati musicians, and one of them, I think, was DeFelice. This is when James was trying to expand beyond just doing funk music, but trying to do some other things. Did you work on any of those sessions?
Yes. In fact, it's possible that the very first session that the DeFelice trio recorded for James, I think I was the arranger of it. I think Jimmy McGarry was playing tenor, and I think I played trumpet, and Frank Brown, who was a great Cincinnati trumpet player, was the other trumpet on the session. Dollar at that time was the drummer and leader of the best known funky band in Cincinnati, a white band. So James had heard Bo Dollar and he wanted to have Bo in his band play some stuff for him. James recognized Bo Dollar's talent and groove, and so I was involved with Bo Dollar and those other Cincinnati people.
Wasn't Bo Dollar in the Daps?
Yes, I think he was probably the leader of the group called the Daps. That is correct.
Well, one band that James Brown collaborated was your band. Can you tell us a little bit about the band that you recorded with James Brown and what your memories of those sessions were and what kind of music that was?
That band was the band that James first heard me and the others in a club in Mount Adams in Cincinnati. And that band was really led by Jimmy McGarry, who was like the premier bebop tenor player in Cincinnati. So he invited me to join the band. And when I joined the band, we took on the name The Sound Museum. I think we recorded possibly two albums were released by the Sound Museum.
I think there were some members from Sound Museum that was in your project called Grodeck Whipperjenny. And can you describe what that music was and who were some of the band members?
I think when we started Grodeck Whipperjenny, we left Jimmy McGarry and it became kind of an acid rock jazz funk band. It's hard to describe, but if you've heard any of the tracks from that Grodeck Whipperjenny record, you'll know what I mean. It was very kind of esoteric. And I don't know if anybody else can notice it, but when I listen to it, I can see my conservatory training that the form of some of those rock and roll pieces is conceived like Mozart was, or Beethoven would have conceived a chamber piece, but with a fuzz guitar and heavy backbeat drums, it became psychedelic rock.
And James Brown put your album out. I think that album was the first album put out on the People's label.
Thank you. I believe it was the first album on the People's label. And the way that came about, James instructed me to write a psychedelic album. I guess in that period of time, in like late 60s, psychedelic music was all over the radio. And so he told me to write a psychedelic record. Well, I'm not sure I knew what a psychedelic record was, but I put together a lot of my different influences with a fuzz guitar and some classical forms and some funky beats. And we ended up with Grodek Whipperjenny, which unfortunately only made one album.
You guys recorded an album with James, and it was actually the last album put out on King Records, and it was called Sure Is Funky Down There, and you are backing James Brown.
Yeah, Show Is Funky Down There. That was the Grodek Whipperjenny band. Kenny Poole, myself, Grove Mooney, I think maybe Jimmy Madison, the young virtuoso drummer. When he was in high school, he was really great and played with the professionals all the time. Jimmy Madison and Michael Moore, who actually had been my roommate at CCM and is one of the great bass players. So I put together this band, was basically jazz musicians to play psychedelic rock. That became the group that made that record. So it's Funky Down Here and the other record we just mentioned.
I think James, is he playing keyboards on that album?
Yeah, basically it's an instrumental record.
Hang on to the north.
Do you have much memories of how that session went? Was it live?
Well, let's see. It was basically live. I think we may have, on the same session, recorded the rhythm tracks and then overdubbed solos on top of it. But basically, it was keyboard, guitar, bass, drums, rock quartet. Actually, I was playing a little bit of valve trombone at the time. I think I played a valve trombone solo on one track on that. Wait a minute. And then Mary Ellen Bell. Mary Ellen Bell was from Dayton, Ohio, and she was a really, really outstanding jazz singer. And we worked with her quite a bit doing jazz stuff in Mount Adams. And we worked at Vic Cassano's pizza place in Dayton, Ohio with Mary Ellen. So when we made the Grodek Quipper Jenny record, I realized the rock and roll record needs some vocals on it. So I called Mary Ellen, and then she and I and Kenny Poole, she sang well, and the others of us just did what we could.
What was it like to actually collaborate with James Brown?
People over the years have asked me, were James Brown and I friends? And my answer has been for all these years, James Brown was like the emperor. You cannot be friends with the emperor. You know, he's James Brown. So I can say, no, I was not friends with James Brown. I had a very strong working relationship with him. So I'm really happy about that. And the things that Hal Neely, Hopgood, and James would listen to what had been recorded, and then they would, between themselves, decide what would be James's next single. And they release it, and then we do the next one. So I just feel so lucky that I happened to be at the right place at the right time and got that experience with one of the great creators of American music.
Hello, I'm Chuck Sullivan. I played guitar in a band called Bo Dollar and the Coins back in the 60s. Started playing with him in 1966. And when I started with him, there were four of us playing at the Blue Angel downtown Cincinnati. It was Bo on drums, Bill Jones on the bass guitar, Wayne Bullock on the organ, myself. And the thing about these guys is they had all recently been playing in Lonnie Mack's band, traveling on the road with him. Got tired of the road and came back to Cincinnati. Bo started his own band. They allowed me to become the guitar player.
Now, you eventually did a little bit of recording with Bo Dollar, and I think you did a session with Lonnie Mack producing, right?
Right. The second week I was with Bo, I started playing this song called Soul Serenade. I showed it to Bo, and he liked it, and he wanted to do it a little more up-tempo, more like a shuffle. And he went to a little studio east of Louisville, because we couldn't get into King Records that week. They were all booked up. Barry Carlson, Fraternity Records, wanted to get us in the studio as soon as possible to record this thing. And so anyway, we went down to this little studio east of Louisville. I think it was called Sambo Recording. When we pulled in the lot, Lonnie's car was there, and I said, "Hey, Bo, there's Lonnie's Cadillac." So we got in the studio, and my amplifier was acting up, making an ugly noise. And Lonnie said, "Well, let's just go out to the car. I've got my amplifier in the trunk of the car." So we got his Magnatone amplifier, and I just started playing through it. And just the way he had it set up, I didn't really touch the controls. And that's when we recorded the song. They heard that vibrato of that Magnatone amplifier, and everybody just assumed it was Lonnie. When the record came out, it said produced by Lonnie Mack. They just assumed he played the guitar on it. For all those years, nobody knew it was me.
Now, I think you left the band for a while, but then you regrouped with Bo Dollar a couple years later, and you did some recording at King Studios with him.
Yes, I left him about middle of 1967, and he called me and wanted me to come back with him again in early 69. And by that time, he had became involved with James Brown. James Brown was using him on some of his sessions because he really liked Bo's drumming, because he was such a funky drummer. And that's what James really liked about his drumming. We went to the studio at King Records. Bo was going to play on a song that James had wrote and produced, and it was a song for Bobby Bird. Bobby Bird was a good friend of James Brown. They grew up together, and Bobby Bird was on the original Flames, and occasionally James would put out a song featuring Bobby Bird. Well, that day, we did a song called Hang Ups. There were four of us, myself on guitar, Bo on drums, Panny Sarkisianis was playing bass, and James Brown is playing organ, which at that point I never even knew he could play organ. So that was my one and only time at King Records on a session.
Did they do redubbing? Do you have much memory of how that recording session went?
Well, that was live, four of us. And then later, James Brown used the horns of his band to add on the horn tracks to the song.
What was the song about?
Back in those days, James would do like message songs, I called them. Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and things like that. Well, that particular song was a song called Hang Ups. It went something like, hang ups we don't need, hunger we've got to feed, hang ups, and James would sing along the harmony part while they were singing that part of the song.
James Brown would sometimes, when you guys performed live in town, he would sometimes show up and play with you guys, right?
Yes, we were the house band at the Inner Circle at that time. We played there six nights a week, and occasionally when James would come to town with the large entourage, he'd come into the Inner Circle on a Sunday night. It would be a packed house that night, and he would come in with a big group, and he would get up and do a dozen of his songs with us because he was comfortable that we would be able to back him up without messing things up for him. He did that probably three or four different times. He came into the Inner Circle and sat in with us.
Now, at that time, the Inner Circle, that's what now is Bogart's, but I guess the way Bogart's looks now does not look like how the Inner Circle looked like.
Well, Bogart's started out, it was going to be a jazz club. It was pretty fancy looking in there when it was the Inner Circle. It had a nice bandstand and a nice dance floor, and started out, Cal Collins was in there with a group playing jazz, and it just didn't go over that well. Cincinnati's not that strong on supporting jazz at that time, so they decided to put us in there with a soul band. Bo hired some horns, and we went in there with four horns with us to do soul music. And like I said, we became the house band there, and we played there for over a year, playing six nights a week.
When you came back the second time, how much longer did you play with Bo Dollar?
I played with him probably about another 6 or 7 months, and he had changed the format of the music. Before, we were strictly a soul band, which that's what I enjoyed playing. At that time, Bo decided he was going to do more top 40 and doing like Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Na Na, Hey, Hey, Goodbye and that kind of stuff. And I just wasn't happy playing it, so I told Bo I was leaving the band. He would have to replace me. So that's when I left him in the latter part of 69.
Did you guys keep in touch? Because I know he passed away a few years ago. I was wondering if you know what he had been doing over the years.
He had stayed around town for a couple of years and started a record label and released a couple of songs. and he released one song that we recorded at the Soul Serenade session. It was a song called I've Just Gotta Forget You by Bobby Blue Bland. He released that as a B-side for one of his records. I think the A-side was called No More Pain. And then after that, he moved to Nashville and was doing some work down there in some studios. And I wasn't in touch with him after that. Then later I heard he left the music business and moved to Florida doing some other line of work. I never was in touch with him until about 1990 maybe. I talked to him. I was able to get a hold of him and try to get him to get back into playing some music, and he didn't want to do it. He wasn't happy with the music scene anymore and just didn't want no part of it. And then he died a couple years after I had talked to him.
Well, how would you describe his drumming? Because he did do a lot of stuff for James Brown Productions. You see his name on different things.
He was such an awesome drummer and a singer along with that. Like I said, when I started with him, there were just four of us, and we played six nights a week. And he couldn't do all that singing all night long, so we were afforded the opportunity to play a lot of instrumentals, which I got to do a lot of Lonnie Mack stuff and Freddie King, and we did a lot of Jimmy McGriff and Jimmy Smith organ stuff and just jazzy soul instrumentals. And Bo was a fantastic drummer. He sang and played drums at the same time. He could pull it off.
Do you have a favorite James Brown story that comes to mind?
That particular day that we was in the studio, for some reason, he decided he was going to do a slow blues song, which was kind of not the thing that he was doing during that time. And he started off singing a slow blues, and he wanted me to just fill in, play some guitar stuff. So I'm throwing out this stuff, and he stopped the session right in the middle. And he says, hold it, man, hold it. Too much B.B. King. And I was playing a lot of blue B.B. King licks, and he didn't want that on this recording. And I thought, well, if he didn't like that, he's not going to like me playing like my Freddie King stuff, like Lonnie Mack. So I really didn't have any Chuck Sullivan to give him. I didn't really have a style of my own. I had sit and learned to play like all those other guys. So he said, you got to get your own thing. Don't copy nobody else. I don't copy nobody. I do my own thing. And that's what you need to do. So that was my lesson there. I never copied any guitar players after that. I started working on learning my own style.
Are you still playing?
Well, I do some occasional things. Like I've done a couple of things at Fountain Square, like the Beer Festival and another festival for King Records last year. And I occasionally go out to jam sessions and sit in and play a few songs. But a lot of the old stuff that I do, a lot of the younger players, they don't know that stuff. So kind of hard for me to find some guys to jump in there and sit in with because they don't know the old instrumentals and stuff that I play.
You've been listening to a special in honor of the 75th anniversary of King Records about James Brown Productions. The second part of this special features conversations with two of the Sisters of Righteous, Jimmy Raley and Waddell Fallon from the famous Flames, Solars, and Expressions, Dr. Kay Robinson, plus Dave Parkinson and Eddie Setzer from the Dabs. I'm host and co-producer along with Brian Powers. Technical assistance from Andy Balterman, Michael Grayson, Jim Nolan, and Josh Elstro. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.